You ready? All right, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome, thank you for coming. My name is Brian Harry. I know I've talked to a couple of you in the audience. A few of you may know me. I've got a fairly well-read blog, and I do a lot of speaking, so I get around. I've been at Microsoft a good long time now. It's been over 15 years, coming up on 16 years. And I came to Microsoft in 94 when Microsoft acquired a company I was working at called OneTree Software. We built a product called SourceSafe, and that's how I ended up at Microsoft. And then worked on some comm stuff for a while, and then ultimately helped found the .NET Framework team and did that for about probably 5 years. And then helped start the what was then called the Team System team, and I'm responsible for Team Foundation Server. And that's what I do today. The talk that I'm going to give today is it's titled Visual Studio ALM Lessons Learned Through Dogfooding. It's really it's not a product talk. It's not a talk about the features of this product or that product. I do talk about some of our Visual Studio features, and I do talk some about Team Foundation Server, but it's really fundamentally a talk about the challenges of doing software development. And it's in the context of the challenges that we have faced as I've watched specifically developer division evolve over the last 15 years from a relatively small team to a very large team that it is today. And sort of I look at, you know, it's a very frank discussion of a lot of the mistakes that we've made along the way and what we've learned from it and sort of how we keep evolving our process. Process in the software development community, it used to be a really bad word. It's a little less of a curse word than it used to be, but it's often sort of tagged with this notion of heavyweight, painful, somebody coming and telling me what I have to do. But I try not to talk too much about process with a capital P, because that really can be burdensome. But rather about, I do talk a lot about process, but it's fundamentally just about how we do software development. What do you do? How does it work? And sort of my last intro comment is I like this to be an interactive discussion. It's a lot easier if we do it that way. It's a lot more interesting, I think. So if you've got a question, just raise your hand and I'll take it and we'll sort of go from there. All right. So I'm going to start for those who maybe don't know too much about Visual Studio and Visual Studio Application Lifecycle Management. I'm going to start with a brief overview of that, and then take you through a sort of a what do you call a rubberneck view of Visual Studio TFS at Microsoft, where you kind of driving by and you see the action on the side of the road and you're like, oh my God, how did that happen? Well, we're going to talk about how TFS is used at Microsoft, and you'll get to rubberneck it a little bit. And then we'll talk a little bit, sort of go through our development process. So a quick overview of Visual Studio. This is the 2010 version. So sort of the centerpiece of application lifecycle management is Team Foundation Server. Sort of in the orange here are sort of an overview of the services of Team Foundation Server. A lot of people think of Team Foundation Server as a version control system, and it is that, but it is much more than that. It also has what we call work item tracking and project management. It has build automation capability. It has an extensive reporting capability. It has some basic requirements management features, although not as evolved as we would like it to be. I expect in the next release that's going to be an area where we're investing. And in the 2010 release, we introduced test case management, so testing and application quality was a huge part of our 2010 release, and I'll talk a little bit about that in the talk. We also added in 2010 a feature called Lab Management. And Lab Management is a capability that enables me to more easily manage my test environments. I heard a lot from customers about how painful managing test environments is. I've got an application. I need to test it in a bunch of different configurations on different OSs, different network topologies, different languages, different whatever. And I need to find a way to really easily take a build, deploy it into a test environment, run my tests, and then tear it down and go to the next build or the next test environment. And you know, we heard over and over again from customers that they'd spend more time just getting the test environment set up, the test data in place, the test configuration settings correct, than they would actually testing the application. And lab management is a product. There are some talks about it here at TechEd, and you can stop by the booth if you'd like to hear more. We've got a booth dedicated to test and lab management. But it's a product really designed to streamline that and make it really easy. Kind of the scenario I talk about is, imagine if, you know, every night or whatever your frequency is, you have your nightly build. Your product builds, the tester comes in the morning, and they say, all right, what am I supposed to do today? They go to the build page, they see that the build succeeded, it shows what tests were run as part of the build, it shows what check-ins were made, what features, requirements, tasks were checked into that build. It includes a list of the impacted tests, so TFS goes through and analyzes all the changes that were made, compares it to your test coverage data and says, here's the 12 tests that were affected by the code that was checked in yesterday. And by the way, here's a link to a VM already set up that you can connect to and run those 12 tests to validate that that it's working. So that's sort of the dream scenario of just making the tester's life unbelievably easy to come in, have what they need to test, and know what they need to test. So that's sort of Team Foundation Server. Then there's a lot of ways to access Team Foundation Server. There is, of course, Visual Studio. And there are now three, we sort of redone Visual Studio. We used to have role-based, you'd buy developer or tester or architect. Sort of have moved the core Visual Studio product line back into a stacked model, professional, premium, and ultimate. Team Foundation Server is included at some level in all of those if you buy with MSDN. We've also added a test professional product for people who are not developers. So this is a product specifically designed to testers. It does not include compilers, it does not include a debugger, it does not include the designers. It is a product designed for people who do testing, not for people who do development. So if you're a developer, you buy Professional Premium or Ultimate. Premium and Ultimate contain many of the test features. Premium, a lot of the core developer test features. Ultimate contains all of the tester test features and the developer test features. Yeah. Yes.
The product analysts, laptop, they have issues with working with the developer tool.
That's right.
Is there any provision in the future for anything that we can give to, you know, apart from the web interface, to give to our product owners or
right. So the question is, hey, my business analysts aren't so excited about having Visual Studio Team Explorer on their machine because they don't think of themselves as Visual Studio user and don't want that whole Visual Studio thing on their machine, kind of like ick, don't want to touch that. So the web UI is what we have today, and we're going to continue to enhance the web UI. We've added a bunch of SharePoint functionality in 2010. We'll add more what we call sort of built-for-purpose capabilities to the web. The Test Professional product is not part of Visual Studio. It's a standalone WPF application. As we evolve our business analyst capabilities, expect us to go that same route. We will not be sort of long-term expecting business analysts to install Visual Studio on their machine. We recognize that's not a desirable thing. Yeah.
To go off of that too, to answer the question, there's also like a third party like Personified Design.
That's right.
TeamLook, which is part attaches into Outlook, which is awesome.
There are a number of third-party products, although they generally also require Team Explorer to be installed. Yeah.
Licenses, applications, and all that. I'm trying to get our company to get away from that. And effectively, you know, Visual Studio 2010 to get the lab management for one vendor.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to sort of move on from the overview. That's fine. All right. Sort of a little perspective, my perspective on kind of where we've been going with our application lifecycle management solution over the years. V1, which was our 2005 release, sort of the core value proposition it was about was transparency. It was about, hey, I'm the man, I own this development team and I have no idea what they're doing. It's a black box. All I know is it's always late and it's over budget. I have no idea why. And I don't know what's happening. I need to know what's happening. How do we sort of provide that without overburdening the developers with, you know, feeling like all they're doing is going to status meetings and reporting what they did yesterday, which of course was nothing because all they did was go to status meetings yesterday. So really we were trying to make sure that we collect data, sort of everything you do, whether you're checking in code or you're doing builds or you're running tests or whatever you're doing, we're constantly collecting data. And we're providing all of that data through a warehouse in sort of a transparent way that people can get insight into what's happening in your project. 2008, I think of as sort of a V1.1 product. It really wasn't a V2. It was a relatively small increment on top of V1. The 2010 product was really our V2. And 2010 was about bringing development and test together. So we did a huge investment in the test stuff, but with a very specific twist. It was about making it possible for the developer and tester to really collaborate well together. Because a lot of the problems that we see is not just, oh, that the testers need better tools. There are a lot of good test tools out there. The problem is that, quite honestly, the developers and testers, they often don't get along. They often don't particularly like each other. The conversation, or you know, if you sort of interview them, it kind of goes like this. Hey, developer, what do you think of those testers? Man, they don't know what the product does. They're always filing bugs that make no sense. They don't repro when I try them. They're just wasting my time. You ask the tester, hey, what do you think of those developers? They don't care about quality. They just ignore my bugs. And they say that they don't repro on their machine. And it's not very effective. So the really interesting sort of challenge is to figure out how to bring those two together. And instead of sort of viewing each other somewhat skeptically, how do we get them to view each other as true partners in the development process and to be effective? So that was V2. V3 is a question mark. We are planning it right now. In a few months, I hope I'll be able to tell you what I think the core value proposition of V3 is. Got some ideas, but that's a conversation for a later date. All right, so here for the rubbernecking exercise. So just a little bit on sort of adoption of TFS at Microsoft and some statistics. So where are we today? These statistics were pulled a few weeks ago. We're at 22,000 unique active users. So 22,000 people at Microsoft are using Team Foundation Server. You can ignore total active users because there's some double counting in there. Projects, there are 5,000 team projects at Microsoft. There are 6,600,000 work items and 91 million source code files. Now that's distinct source code files. That doesn't count branches. If you count branches and multiply that, you know, times the number of files, it's like billions. They're literally billions. But that's distinct source code files. And to give you kind of some idea of growth over time, the second chart shows if you look at adoption of TFS at the time we released the 2008 version compared to the time that we released the 2010 version, the number of TFS instances at Microsoft nearly doubled from 24 to 40. The number of active users, tripled from 7,000 to 22,000. Projects, 4 times. Work items 6 times, and source code files almost 4 times. So adoption at Microsoft is growing like crazy. I think I've got one other slide that kind of shows that, which is, so this is sort of a graph of users from the various teams at Microsoft. Almost every team at Microsoft uses TFS in some way. As you can see, our internal IT team has the most users at almost 4,500. Developer division is the second largest team at 3,500, but you'll see Windows and Office and Microsoft.com and et cetera. So a lot of teams at Microsoft using Team Foundation Server, and that's sort of, if you add all that up, it adds up to the 22,000 people. So we have a whole lot of people using it. The developer division instance is the largest instance at Microsoft. These stats were taken at a slightly different time than the previous page, but they're close. At the time we took it, there were 3,800 recent users of the Developer Division instance. That's recent users as anybody who's used it in the last week. It was 18.7 terabytes of storage, so kind of a big system. 826 million files. Now that is counting branches. So it was 91 million total if you don't count branches. 826 million just in Developer Division if you count branches. 1.6 million check-ins have been done and almost a million work items. Here's a little picture of our architecture. So we have sites in Redmond, China, North Carolina, Europe, and India. We've got a bunch of proxy servers. We've got a pretty large scale TFS server and a lot of clients, and the build lab is, build lab kicks off 80 builds a night. Every night builds 80 builds. That's a huge load on the server. Yep. If we're building TFS, what's the version of, so we have a very clear staging in which we adopt versions of TFS for internal adoption. And we're on TFS 2010 now. In fact, we just finished upgrading to TFS 2010 about a month ago. So now everybody's on it. We will move to the next version of TFS in about the beta 1 timeframe. That's when we'll upgrade to the next one. So that's a good question. Our build lab has historically been physical. We had a very, very large, you know, room with hundreds of machines. We are now moving to virtual and off-site. So in the next version of Visual Studio, they're in a data center and you don't even have access to them. It's lights out. Our whole build lab is hosted off-site through virtual machines in a data center. All right, so now let's get to sort of a little bit of the lessons learned. So I'll kind of go through a little bit of a waterfallish discussion in terms of structuring the order of this thing. So I'm going to start off with planning a release. So when you start in the very beginning, especially in a large organization, now our organization is extremely large. I think a lot of what I'm going to say is true for even smaller, for much smaller organizations, but certainly, the more people involved, the harder the planning process is. What you're trying to establish in planning is, what am I going to deliver? And what is the value being delivered, right? If you put yourself in the position of the sort of the business decision maker, you're trying to figure out, there's an infinite number of things I could do. So I'm trying to figure out, what are the most important things for me to do? And once I've figured out what those most important things for me to do are, how do I get the organization aligned behind that? How do I get everybody to understand these are our priorities and to understand how what they are going to do is going to align with those priorities? If I look back, you know, over the years at Visual Studio, we have an expression we call peanut buttering. And that comes from the way we've historically done planning. The way we've done planning is we got a bunch of people. People get broken down into teams, into sub-teams, into sub-teams, and we'd say, okay, it's time to do the next release. Everybody go plan the next release. So what that means is everybody goes off, takes their little list of features, figures out what the most important of their little list of features is, and then we go build it. And what we get is a whole bunch of features sort of randomly scattered throughout the organization. And the product is more defined by the organizational structure than by any particular business goals that we had. And we sort of describe it, you know, the analogy to spreading peanut butter is you get a large coverage area, all very thin. So you get a little bit of a whole lot of things. And that's not very effective for the organization. It's not very effective for our customers, quite honestly. And it really, the marketing guys really hate it. Because what ends up happening is we go build this thing, and the marketing guys kind of come in at the end and they say, okay, how am I going to describe it to customers? And they get this list, you know, that's like 100 things long of here's all the features we built. And the marketing guys are going like, okay, I can tell them three things because they're not going to remember a list of 100 things, and I can't even, like, there's no way I can explain it. So they end up trying to come back and make sense out of this large arbitrary list of features that we built. So the question is, how do we fix that? How do we make it so that we understand what we're going to build? We understand the priority of what we're going to build, and in the end, we deliver something that makes sense to our customers and we can communicate. How do we, there's sort of software aspects and there's organizational aspects, but fundamentally, how do we shift, how do we define the key priorities, shift our resources, and get things aligned with it? So let me tell you a little bit about how we do it. So first, as you might expect, and I hope you like the colors, I did that just for you. I'll talk a little bit about how we do this. So this is a process we've evolved over the past probably 5 or 6 years, where we start the planning process by defining what we call the pillars of the release. And even for an organization the size of Visual Studio, so we're talking like a 2,500-person organization, we'll have order three pillars. So they are the very high-level statement of what we're trying to accomplish, usually driven by business objectives. So to make this concrete, let's talk about the 2010 release. So we had two pillars for the application lifecycle management of Visual Studio. We did this exercise for 2010. The rest of Visual Studio really didn't. We're doing it with the rest of Visual Studio for the next release. We had two application lifecycle management pillars. One was called test and application quality, and the other was called business alignment. Business alignment, people look at me and go, what's business alignment? Well, it's the process I'm talking about right now, which is the process of figuring out how I'm going to get my organization aligned to my business priorities. So those were our two core pillars for this release. So we then take our core pillars and we break them down into value propositions. So a value proposition is some high-level statement that you can make to a customer about why this release is going to really help them. So let's take an example from the test and application quality pillar. As we were sort of exploring the problem space of test and application quality, we sort of locked in on a really core problem that people had, and that was what we called the no repro bug. So we had a value proposition called eliminate the no repro bug, which was make it so that every time a tester reports a bug, the developer is able to identify that bug and fix it. I had a bunch of other value propositions. I talked about lab a moment ago. I basically described the lab value proposition. We had a bunch of them. Three pillars, and then under each pillar, let's say 6 to 10 value propositions under each pillar. The value proposition is then basically broken down into features, and features into sub-features and sub-features. So that's, that part of the tree is hierarchical. Let's talk about features for a minute. Let's take our eliminate the no repro bug value proposition. So that was broken down into a bunch of features. So we said, okay, let's look at the causes of no repro bugs. Well, one of the causes is the developer or the tester ran a test, they reported a bug, but they actually didn't report the steps that they did. They did something else, their machine was in kind of a slightly different state, they clicked on something that they forgot to say that they clicked on, and of course the developer can't reproduce it because they don't actually have accurate steps for what the tester did. So we had a feature to address that problem, which was the ability to video record what the tester was doing. So literally, as the tester's doing their tests, we video record the entire thing, and when they file a bug, the video recording is automatically attached to the bug. So the developer can actually watch what the tester was doing. Well, you're like, okay, that's cool. What other kind of problems do we have? Well, it might be that something went wrong in the application that was very non-obvious from what the tester did. It might have been something that was wrong with the data. It might have been something that was wrong with, it might have been a random issue, because things obviously in software, sometimes randomness creeps in. So how can we sort of solve that problem? So we built a feature called IntelliTrace. IntelliTrace is a feature that records inside the application as the tester is testing it and is recording not a video of what they're doing, but rather the flow of the code. So it's actually recording every method that's called and all the parameters that are passed to those methods. When the tester, again, sees a bug, they file the bug, automatically that's attached to the bug report. The developer can open the trace file inside of Visual Studio, and up comes the debugger, which includes the history of everything that's happened. So the developer can actually look, oh, okay, this is where it is in the debugger. I see it's wrong, but I'm not sure how it got wrong. They can step backwards through the trace of the application and see, oh, this function was called from that function. Oh, and before that it called this function and it returned this value. Hey, wait a minute, that value is not right. Track it back to where the error actually happened. So that was another feature. So one more example of a feature. Another source of error. Maybe the tester's not testing the same version of the application that the developer's testing. In fact, it's almost never the case that the tester's testing the same version of the application. Because how does it work? The way it works is the tester gets some official build off of some build machine somewhere that's packaged up into some kind of a setup file that they install and test, and that's what they're testing. How many of you developers have that version on your machine? No, I have what I sunk out of the source control system and built, and may or may not have some changes that I'm in the middle of making at the moment. Right? It is what I have to try to reproduce that bug on is nothing whatsoever like what the tester had. Besides, the tester might have filed that bug a week ago, and who knows how many check-ins have happened in the last week. So that is another very common source for the developer not being able to reproduce what the tester saw. So we have two new features called Source Server and Symbol Server that enables when I pull up, to use my IntelliTrace example, I pull up that IntelliTrace log inside the debugger. The executable has in it all of the symbol data necessary to know what versions of the sources went into build, the version of that application that the tester was testing. As I'm stepping through that code, it's not opening the files off of my hard drive that happened to be sitting there. It's actually going out to TFS, pulling down the version of the source code that was used to build that version of the application, and that's what I'm debugging. So I'm actually debugging the exact source that was designed or that was used to build the application the tester tested. So, example of three features, and those features are broken down into sub-features. So then that sort of is how we categorize the work. Ultimately, as we do the work, we take off groups of features and we sort of build them in what you might call sprints or iterations, and the result of a sprint or an iteration is what we call a deliverable. And I will talk a bit more in a minute about how deliverables work. So all of this stuff literally is captured in TFS. So pillars is a work item in TFS, value propositions is a work item in TFS, feature is a work item in TFS. And as you can see, sort of got the links tab shown here. They're all linked together, so I get full traceability of these things. You can use Microsoft Excel to add them, to edit them and to review them. In 2010, we added hierarchy support for work items in TFS, and Excel can be used to manage the hierarchy. You can use Microsoft Project if you like it, and we do both. In fact, I usually make a comment here. People look at me, you know, there's sort of two classes of people. There's people who come to me and they want more project features and more project server and more. There's the other people who look at me and go, we do Scrum. Why would I want that project thing? Like, why are you doing anything with project? And the truth is we do both. We do some stuff in project and we do some stuff in a much more manage my backlog, pick off the highest priority features, and iterate kind of methodology. So how do we decide which one we do? I characterize it as follows. I sort of loosely describe there's two kinds of features that we build, what I call long dark tunnel features and value add features. What is a long dark tunnel feature? A long dark tunnel feature is a feature where once you commit to it, you can't stop until you're done. There's no off-road. And it is a long feature. It's going to take a long time and a lot of people to do. So an example, in Visual Studio 2010, we replaced the editor. We built a new editor from scratch, WPF, extensible, a lot of cool stuff about it. It was a massive undertaking. I mean, when you sort of look at how many people ultimately had to do editor work, there were many hundreds, if not over 1,000, who at some point had to do something because the editor changed. And it took probably 2 years from the time it started till it ended. So you're not going to run a 1,000-person, 2-year sprint. That doesn't make any sense. On the other hand, you are not going to stop halfway. You're not going to say, oh, we got to the release date. We got the highest priority features. We're done. The editor, you know, it doesn't work with VB this time, but that's okay. We'll get that next time. You know, we really had to be done. So that kind of feature I call a long dark tunnel feature. And those we use more of a traditional waterfall approach. We're going to do a lot of upfront design and analysis. We're going to understand the dependencies. We're going to understand the schedule implications. Those drive our overall schedule. That tells us roughly how long it's going to take to ship this product. The other 95% of the features that we do, and I made up 95%, but it is a large majority, are more what I'd call value add features. And that is, hey, it would be great if we get this feature in, but it's not going to kill us if we don't. The product is still viable without this feature. Those we manage as a prioritized backlog. We pick them off. We do sprints. We, you know, iterate, much more sort of the traditional agile scrum kind of model. We do a mix of both. The overall schedule is driven by the long dark tunnel features. Most of the value is driven by an iterative kind of approach. So project plays a role in what we do. Right.
We put in the top part the project plan, and underneath we did a conjunction of all the sprint burn downs for each sprint leading up to the point where we were, slowly introducing the idea subliminally about effectively what the sprint burn downs were. So they started gravitating more towards the bottom rather than worrying so much about the top.
Cool. All right. So, talking about those senior executives. How many of your senior executives are real excited about looking at a big, long list of tasks and features and trying to figure out how much progress you're making? None I've met. By dumping all of this data into TFS and using TFS to track this, this is a view we use to communicate to our management what we're doing. So here's a report we've built. Down the left-hand side, you can see the pillars. So there were actually, I said there were two pillars. There was actually a hidden third pillar, which we called eliminate dissatisfiers. So we had sort of this bucket that nothing quite, you know, that a bunch of other stuff didn't fit into. It was about addressing customer dissatisfiers. But you can see here your core business investments, what your pillars were. The next sort of shows you your value proposition. What are the core value propositions? This is something your management ought to understand. They ought to understand what your pillars were, because those are your business priorities. They ought to understand what your value propositions are. These are the things that are going to deliver on those business priorities. Below that, they don't care. So we roll up all that data and we just show, you know, this data sort of shows two simple things. The length of the bar says, here's how big the investment is in this particular value proposition. And the blue bar shows how much of it's done. So they can kind of look at this and see, okay, yep, I see you've got sort of, you know, good distributed investment across these things. I see you're putting, you know, more in this bucket than the other. I see kind of the relative cost of the value propositions in there, and I can see you're making good progress. You know, as you go through, you know, monthly updates of this or something, kind of see progress that you're making. It's a very, very simple way to roll up the fine-grained status that the development team does up to something that the management team can understand. All right, so that's sort of planning. Let's talk a little bit about how we organize the development work itself. So to some degree, part of our development challenge is driven by the fact that we're a very large organization. And I'll try to highlight here the stuff that is sort of specific to that, although not that much of it is. The reality is software development is just complicated, no matter how you do it, no matter how big your organization is. Once you get over two or three people, it's complicated. So a few years ago, we introduced this notion that we call feature crews. What is a feature crew? A feature crew is a small team, a small cross-discipline team, developers, testers, and program managers, who work together to deliver some capability. So a feature crew generally for us runs between 10 and 15 people. So we've got a ton of feature crews inside our 2,500-person organization. They execute relatively independently. They decide what methodology they're going to use. They might use Scrum, they might use XP, they might use Waterfall, they might use whatever. They decide what their development process is going to be. They pick off some set of features that they're going to deliver. They commit to delivering it. And ultimately, they're accountable for delivering the quality, delivering quality on those features. If I sort of look pre-feature crew model, what used to happen? What used to happen is everybody worked in one big branch in TFS, or it was actually pre-TFS, it was the previous version control system, but everybody worked in one big branch, and they just checked in their daily work, and everybody was happy, or not. What were some of the bad things about that? Well, among the bad things were we would build up a ton of debt in the system. What would happen is, if you sort of look at our previous development methodology, we used a very waterfall methodology. We would have this notion of code complete. We would work up to code, you know, we'd do feature, up to code complete. You know, after code complete, there would be a period of stabilization and testing that would get us to test complete, and then test complete down to bug, you know, bug complete, and da-da-da, very, very waterfallian. And what would happen is you would see what I called feature rush. Everybody would have this idea of the set of features they want to build, and they knew if they didn't get them done by code complete that the feature wasn't going to make it into the product. So what do people do? They go as fast as they possibly can to get to the point that they can demo the feature, and they call it code complete. Is that code complete? It's not even close to code complete, right? I call it demo complete. So what would happen is we'd build up all this debt of half-finished features. And then we'd spend, I mean, a long time. We'd spend literally sometimes a year from demo complete to actual code complete, to where you could say, yes, those features are actually coded and they work. And I'm going to show you sort of some graphs showing sort of bug trends and sort of how that's evolved over time here in a minute. But enough sort of on the high level, the way it, you know, the bad old days, the way it used to be, we introduced feature crews to say, okay, we're going to stop that. We're going to build in sort of well-defined chunks, and every feature crew works in a branch. We call them feature branches. So every feature is independent of the mainline until it's done. And you don't get to check in your feature into the mainline until you pass what we call a quality gates. And I've got I got some more data. I'm going to talk to you more about what the quality gates are. But fundamentally, it's a way of measuring that you're actually done. Your tests are written. It's passing all the tests. You've got good code coverage. You've got dot, dot, dot. And that's how we make these teams accountable for delivering quality. And it's how we make sure that we don't build up all of that sort of demo debt. So within these feature crews, as I say, they have a lot of autonomy to decide how they want to run. Makes them happy that they're not sort of told, hey, you must run exactly this way. But then you also have the question of, well, how do you know, you got 100 of these things, how do you have any insight into what they're doing if they're kind of all doing their own thing? We have a relatively simple way that we do that. We have a set of checkpoints that every one of our feature crews goes through. We have creatively called them checkpoint 0, 1, and 2, and then the final completion checkpoint. The first checkpoint is about scope. So every feature crew, they've sort of picked off a set of features, and what they essentially are responsible for at scope is to say, here's the problem we're solving. We're going to go build some stuff that does X for the customer. And sort of as a management team, we can kind of look at it and go, that is a great problem to solve. Or, you know, really think you ought to turn it this way a little bit. That's not exactly the sweet spot of what customers are looking for. But define the scope. The second checkpoint is the plan. So tell me what you're going to build. Show me a screenshot, storyboard, rough schedule. Give me some idea that you've thought through and you actually have a solution to the problem that you described to me last time. Checkpoint two is the demo. I've built it. It's done. I mean, it's demo done, right? It's demo complete. I can show you that it's been built. Everything's happening in a branch. If at any point along here we go, oh, this feature's taking too long, it's not working out the way we thought, this is not going to be a very valuable feature, customers are telling us we got to go do something else, bam, we can shoot it, just delete that branch and go on back to do something else. And then the end is the quality gates and merge. So I'll talk a little bit more about the details of that in a minute. And now a little bit more on sort of some of the tools that we use. I'm going to show you some of the features of 2010 and how we use them in our development process. Here's one of my favorites. In 2010, we built a bunch of new architecture tools. My favorite architecture tool is called the layer diagram. And I remember vividly a couple of years ago sitting in a conference room talking about what we wanted to do with architecture tools and having a conversation about this horrible problem that we had in Team Foundation Server. In Team Foundation Server 2005, so we started building Team Foundation Server in about the beginning of 2003. And there were only three of us on the team when we started building this thing. And as with most small teams, we had a pretty clear picture of what we wanted to build. We communicated well. In fact, at the time, we all shared the same office. So we had a really good, clear, common picture of what we were going to build, had a nice architectural layering of how we wanted to build the system. We understood what the components were and how they related to each other. Over the couple of years of building Team Foundation Server, the team grew a lot. In fact, by the time we shipped it, the team was about 75 people, I think. Well, somehow you don't invest as much as you ought to in making sure everybody who comes onto the project comes up to speed and understands all of the principles and architecture that you laid out before. And let's just say the architecture evolves, not necessarily in the direction you intended it to evolve. So the Team Foundation Server 2005 architecture evolved. When we shipped Team Foundation Server 2005, and I'm not particularly proud of this, but I tell it like it is, we actually shipped with the server, had a dependency on system.windows.forms. It loaded system.windows.forms into the IIS server process. Now, at some level, you could say it didn't actually do any harm, it didn't cause it to crash or anything, but you clearly don't want system.windows.forms in your IIS server process. It makes no sense. Only bad things can happen if you do that. So why did that happen? Well, as I say, we had a clear architectural layering of components both on the client and on the server. And there was this one component that was a shared utility assembly that was to be used on both the client and server and just had some shared utility code for, parsing paths and, doing basic utility capabilities. Well, some developer somewhere deep into the project who we had clearly not communicated effectively what the architecture of the system was, added some code to that that had some GUI code in it because it had some other client code in it. And he's like, sure, I'll just put it in here. And he never knew that it was the wrong place to put it. The people on the team who did know never caught it. So it was, 6 months before we were supposed to ship when we discovered that this was in there. And by that time, the dependencies had been built up that there was no way to take it back out. So we ended up shipping it in there. And I will thankfully say we have subsequently removed it. But it was a significant undertaking to unwind all those dependencies that build up over time. So, enter the layer diagram. What is the layer diagram? Well, it is a solution to this problem. The layer diagram allows me to draw an abstract architecture of my system, what I call layers. And in those layers, I define sublayers and components and how they relate to each other. So I can say, hey, this component's allowed to rely on that component, not allowed to rely on that component. And those components might be components I build, or they might be framework components. For example, I could say this assembly is not allowed to depend on system.windows.forms. That's cool. So it's a communication tool. I can now hand this to everybody and say, hey, here's the layering of the system. Make sure you follow it. But we can do better than that. I can associate components of my actual application with layers. So I can say, hey, this assembly is in that layer, this class is in that layer, this namespace is in that layer. And then I can reverse engineer my code and validate that my code actually conforms to the layer. So I'll get an error. If I say validate this layering, goes out, parses all my code, looks at the actual dependencies, and if there's any dependencies between layers that aren't allowed in the diagram, it flags a violation and says, hey, this class, this line is referencing that class in this layer, and it's not allowed to. So I can go fix them. Well, that's good. That, of course, relies on somebody taking the time to go right-click and do the layer, so that's cool, but it's still not good enough. So how do we make it even better? Another feature in TFS 2010 is what we call gated check-in. Gated check-in is the ability to do validation on a check-in before it actually gets checked in. So if you're familiar with continuous integration, I think of gated check-in as the evolution of continuous integration. Continuous integration says every time I check in, I'm going to build it and run some tests and validate and make sure that it's good. Well, what's the downside of that? If it's not good, it's checked in. It's broken. It's good that you can fix it quickly. And for a small team, it works great. Don't get me wrong. For a small team, it works great. Somewhere, my opinion, and it's just my opinion, in the 20-person or so size team, suddenly, if your rule is, hey, you check it in, and if it breaks, we'll fix it, then that rule quickly becomes it's always broken and somebody's fixing it. Yes. Yes. Yeah, his point is, hey, if the people are asleep while you're working, then it doesn't work because by the time you discover it's broken, you're waiting till tomorrow for them to fix it. I've experienced that. That's murder. So gated check-in sort of turns continuous integration on its head and says, hey, what if I check it before it gets checked in? And if it doesn't build, doesn't pass the test, doesn't something, send email back to the developer who checked it in or tried to check it in and say, hey, here's what's broken, fix this and resubmit it. Well, the layer diagram, the architecture enforcement, has a gated check-in capability. So you can actually say every check-in validated against this. So every check-in will go through, analyze the source code, compare the dependencies to the dependencies described in the architecture, and if there's any violation, send it back to the developer with a description of the violation. So you can prevent system.windows.forms from ever getting in to the TFS server. And for that, I would be grateful. All right, so that's one. Another one, mentioned before, Scrum is becoming an increasingly popular project management methodology. We introduced in the 2010 release what we call the Agile Workbooks. This was actually done kind of not from a, hey, let's go design Agile Workbooks, but it was done by looking at the Excel workbooks that several teams in Microsoft had put together to manage their project. And we kind of, merged them and took the best of the different workbooks and pulled together a pretty nice Excel workbook for managing a backlog, breaking down your backlog into iterations, managing planning and iteration and the capacity that you have in that iteration, and then watching the burn down over time. And we call those the Agile workbooks. Now this week we also announced a new Scrum template, which is the thing about the Microsoft MSF Agile process template and the Agile workbooks is they're kind of a generic Agile management. They're not Scrum specific. They don't follow a specific methodology. They're good for any kind of lightweight, backlog-based, iteration-based notion, but they don't prescribe any particular way that you manage that. We found people who really want to practice Scrum, who go get a book on Scrum, take a training class on Scrum, they kind of look at it and they go, but wait a minute, it's an iteration. Scrum uses sprints. And why are you measuring this in hours? Because Scrum uses story points. And it's not quite the same thing. So we've produced a Scrum template now that's available on VS Gallery that's really Scrum. Yeah.
You said earlier that you use checkpoints to improve
features. Yes.
Are you looking at that portfolio across features, is that in some separate area that you're looking at, or is that actually
Got it. So he's asking how checkpoints relate to the actual work done. So we actually don't store checkpoints in TFS. All the work items are stored in TFS. A checkpoint is it's a discussion, kind of like a stand-up is. You wouldn't have your scrum meeting as a work item in TFS because it's a discussion. A checkpoint is also a discussion, so you won't find the checkpoint in TFS. Yes. So do we have any portfolio management that shows the status of each checkpoint? No, we don't do that. The checkpoints don't, we don't show progress through checkpoints. We show progress through task completion. I'll show you some graphs here in a minute that we use to track that. We look at it a variety of different ways. We do look at it by feature crews, so we'll look at completion of feature crews, progress to feature crews, and I've got some good charts that show you how we do that.
So regardless of team, what process they're using, they're all using tasks. So
that's correct. Yeah, they're all doing that pillar, value prop, features, tasks breakdown. All right, so a key component of this notion of feature crews was quality as you go. And we can kind of look at the evolution of quality as you go. If I go back to 2000, I think we did what most everybody did in 2000, which is developers wrote code. When they were done typing it, occasionally they hit build, and they'd chuck it over the wall and expect some tester to tell them whatever was wrong with what they wrote. Around the early 2000s, the industry kind of decided, you know what, this model doesn't work. Around that time, we were evolving this notion of unit testing. Shouldn't developers do some testing on their own? Shouldn't they write some tests, and shouldn't they make sure that as they complete work and they check it in, that there are good tests that cover it? Of course, we've sort of we've taken that all the way to the other way, where you've got TDD now that says, no, you should write the tests before you even write the code. But testing has clearly evolved into a major part of what developers do now. And the same evolution happened at Microsoft. And I say, starting in the early 2000s, we sort of gradually took on more and more notion of testing. And as I say, the quality gates play an important component in making sure that we don't let unfinished stuff into the system. But as I watched this evolution of testing, so we first started with the desire. We want developers to write tests. So in 2005, we said, you shall write tests. And what happened? Nobody wrote tests. They didn't particularly enjoy it. They didn't understand the importance of it. And we had a pretty meek effort of writing tests. And the lesson I learned from that is something a friend of mine told me long, long ago. You get what you inspect, not what you expect. So if you want to make sure to have people writing tests, you ought to occasionally look at how people are doing writing tests. If you never ask that question, then you'll get no tests. So that was sort of the second evolution. The first evolution was, hey, we want you to write tests. The second evolution is, let's count how many tests are written. Let's look at code coverage. Let's kind of have some objective measure of how much testing you did. So that was kind of the 2008 release, where we really focused hard on we set code coverage goals. So the developers will have tests that cover this much code. We started really injecting testing into our daily conversation about what we were doing. And in 2008, the developers wrote a lot of tests. I felt really, really good about it. I think and I'm not going to remember the numbers exactly right, but we sort of did a retrospective at the end of the 2008 release, and one of the things we looked at was how much progress did we make? How did we do at getting developers to take their share of the responsibility for ensuring the quality of what we built? And the developers had written around 6,000 tests for the code that they had written in the 2008 release. At the same time, the QA team had written, Again, I don't remember the exact number, but it was 12,000 or something. Pretty large number on the QA side as well. And, you know, I felt pretty good about that. I'm like, we succeeded. We got the developers to write a bunch of tests, and that's good. The testers, of course, are still writing a bunch of tests, and that's also good. I'm happy about that. But I was digging deeper, and I realized, uh-oh, those 6,000 tests the developers wrote, the testers wrote the same 6,000 tests. So I didn't actually have 18,000 tests. I had 12,000 tests, half of them written twice. This was not what I was thinking. There's still some advantage to it, because the developers find the bug earlier, and they fix it while they're in the code, and that's all good, so it wasn't a total waste, but it definitely was not what I was thinking. What I was thinking was, hey, I want you guys to write some tests, and I want you guys to write some other tests. And so then we started to figure out why. What happened? Why did that happen? And then we really started to understand the next level to which we were not set up to be successful. So what kind of things stood in the way? So first, the developers and testers didn't talk about testing together. They didn't have any notion of a joint test plan. So the testers never asked the developers, hey, which tests did you write? And even if they had, it wouldn't have mattered, because the developers used, you know, a unit testing framework to run their tests. We had this little thing in Microsoft called T-Run, which was how developers on the command line would run their cool little unit tests. The testers, on the other hand, had this thing called Mad Dog. Not going to defend the name, but that is what it is called. It is our internal test case management system that we've used for 15 years to manage the test assets that the testers have. Mad Dog is optimized for running a ton of tests on a ton of different configurations in lab environments and, you know, special logging frameworks for the way they do it. It was totally different than what the developers did. And in fact, no self-respecting developer would allow Mad Dog to touch their machine. Because it was designed for a pristine lab environment, right? It takes over the machine. In fact, when you install Mad Dog, every time you log in, you get like four pop-ups telling you that this machine is under the control of Mad Dog, and you're like, oh my God. So even if they had communicated about what tests they were written, they had no common infrastructure to share, to reuse the same test. So this became part of our mantra under our test and application quality pillar for the 2010 release. We said, hey, this is not okay. It's got to be possible for the developers and testers to work together. I don't want them all writing the same tests twice. Let's get a common test planning system. Let's get a common test execution framework. Let's get a common test reporting system. And let's make sure, we had this mantra, which we called, much like we had eliminate the no repro bug, we had one called a test is a test is a test. And that is, doesn't matter who wrote it, anybody can write it, anybody can run it, anybody can use it. We don't have dev tests and QA tests. We don't have unit tests and functional tests. We just have tests. So that's sort of what quality as you go is about. And then some screenshots, which I won't spend much time, but you know, this is the called Microsoft Test Manager, the test planning tool we use to sort of communicate what the test plan is, what's going to get tested, mapping tests to requirements. Unit testing framework that allows you to manage unit tests inside the IDE so developers can real easily just do, you know, hit F5, run my test, make sure my tests are passing as I'm working. We still had some. So the question is, how many duplicates do we have in 2010? I'm not going to kid you and say it was perfect. We certainly still had some. There were two issues. One is we built a lot of this infrastructure in 2010, so a lot of it wasn't available while we were building 2010. Second, I think we still have some work on the cultural side of getting them to work together better. We are, as part of the next version planning, what we call Dev 11, we're reinvigorating this effort to get developers and testers working together and collaborating on the tests even more. In fact, our methodology is, you know, we do a major release And generally, not between after every major release, but after most major releases, we have a period that we call MQ, or our quality milestone, where we spend, in this case, what we shipped in April, so it was really May, June, part of April, May, June, and July. We take the whole team and we just invest in our engineering process. We build tools for our engineering process. We go back and fix, everything bit rots over time. So we go back and sort of fix up bit rot and try to improve our engineering process. So a big part of our investment in the engineering process this cycle was around addressing the remainder of this test stuff. And we still have a ton of tests written the old way that aren't reusable. So big investment in that. So we did okay in 2010. I think in the next version we'll do even better. My goal is, we'll never get to 100%. I'm not going to try to get to 100%. But my goal is that by and large, we don't write the same test twice. Yeah.
Projects or separate projects, and it seems to be that out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
What is with this bringing this together? What would be your recommendation in regards to making get along? Is unit tests going into separate project? What's your recommendation?
You mean the same? As in the same? The question is: do you put tests in the same solution file, the same project, Visual Studio project, as the code? I would say we don't have a we don't have a hard and fast rule about that. The dev tests do generally go in the same solution, rarely in the same project file, but we'll usually create a tests project. The unit tests will usually go in there. The tests the QA guys write sometimes go in there, but more often they're writing integration tests that are going to instrument a large number of components in the system, so it often doesn't really fit in any particular solution file. So those kind of things will often have their own solution file. But they're all in the same tree, in the same branch, managed the same way. This is the manual testing tool that manual testers can use. Performance and stress testing, we have that in Visual Studio. We do a lot of performance and stress testing. If anybody's familiar, it's fun, another cute story. So how many of you sort of watched the Visual Studio performance debacle around Beta 2 where, let's just say, the performance of Visual Studio at Beta 2 was not so great? Well, I'm glad that not too many of you saw it. But it was bad. We released Beta 2, and within, I'd say, a week, we started getting feedback that the performance was bad. And I have to admit, as sad as I am to admit it, I had not used the product too much in the month or two before the beta. I'd been busy with some other stuff. And so I'm like, okay, fine, let me go look at how bad this is. And it was bad. Things like, you pull up a solution and type, and we had this video, which I posted on my blog, of typing, a relatively long source code line, maybe 60 characters long. And you'd watch the person type, and then they'd stop typing, and the characters would keep coming out. And it was like 10 seconds or 8 seconds from the time they finished typing until the characters stopped showing up. You're like, oh my God, how did that happen? And it's really funny, because we were somewhat flabbergasted by it. Both in the severity of the problem and in the fact that we didn't catch it, because we did more performance work in the 2010 release than we did in any previous release of Visual Studio, yet at the same time the performance was worse in the 2010 release, the beta, than in any previous release of Visual Studio. We did fix it before we shipped. The performance of the RTM is quite good. But we spent a lot of time trying to figure out why. How did this happen? How did we end up with such bad performance? And, the irony, there are many reasons. These things never happen for a single reason. But if I were to kind of point to one of the primary reasons, the irony of it is that it actually happened because this was the release that we invested more in performance than any other release. And, okay, that sounds like a crazy thing to say. What do you mean by that? The reason is because we had a very intense focus on performance in this release. And we wrote, hundreds, if not thousands, of performance tests, measuring everything you could imagine. And the entire product cycle, I mean, starting a year and a half before we shipped, we were running performance tests every night and collecting results and had goals set. And anytime tests were, you know, off the goal, someone would investigate them. So we had a very rigorous attention to performance. But nonetheless, the performance sucked. So how'd that happen? What happened is we had this problem the whole product cycle that we called noisy tests. You write a performance test, and you've got a goal that will run in 1 second, and it runs in half a second. You're like, woohoo, that's great. You run it again, it runs in a second and a half. You're like, oh, crap, that sucks. You run it again, and it's 1 second. Woohoo! You run it again, it's 3 seconds. Dang. So how useful is that as a performance test? Well, it's hard, because it's kind of all over the place. So we had this effort that we called broken and noisy tests, where we had to get our tests so that if it failed, like developers got really pissed if they got called in to investigate a performance failure and it turned out nothing had changed because it was just noisy. They were like, hey, it runs fine on my box. Yeah. And but how do you fix noisy tests? Well, the way you fix a noisy test is you eliminate anything that can introduce sort of randomness. What kind of things introduce randomness? Well, page faults and context switches and, you know, network I/O and, you know, sort of anything like that. Well, okay, so how do I eliminate those things? Well, I make my tests smaller and smaller and smaller until they execute some very, very small section of code that never allocates too much memory so it doesn't cause page faults and never accesses the disk so that it doesn't, I don't get disk issues, never accesses the network. So you get these, what I call micro benchmarks. You get these tests that execute very, very narrow code paths that actually don't do anything interesting. So you'd get a test that would, launch Visual Studio, and it would time the time to create a new, say, C# console application, add one method to it, and compile it, and time it. You're like, okay, how many of you do that? What happens more likely? Well, what's more likely is I've got a project with 1,000 files in it, and 4 WinForms designers open, and I've run the debugger 2 or 3 times, and maybe the profiler once, and now I edit my file. And it's totally different. It's not the same thing. And it turns out, when you sort of ran it in real-world scenarios, the performance sucked. If you ran it in a little micro-benchmark case, it was okay. So we've really sort of rethought how we approach performance testing in that respect and have done a lot more focus on real-world scenarios, real-world applications. In fact, between beta 2 and release, we worked with a bunch of customers to collect some very, very large real-world applications. We've got probably a couple dozen now, ranging from, all of them are large, but I think some of them are, oh, I don't even know how big the biggest one is. Hundreds of solutions, or hundreds of projects, tens, hundreds of thousands of lines of code, pretty large projects. I'm sorry, yes?
In the previous scenario you described, the bugs found after release?
Yes.
Microsoft often sends the patches, is it correlated, and again tested into the same
site? I'm sorry, does Microsoft what patches?
So
what I described was what happened at beta, and we fixed all that stuff before RTM shipped. Now, of course, there are more bugs in RTM. You find them, we find them. And yes, we do patch. We release patches fairly regularly. I want to say we probably average 5 to 10 patches a month that we'll release for various customer-reported problems. All right, so all of that data rolls up into dashboards and gives you visibility into what the heck's going on in your project. And we did a bunch of work in 2010 for the dashboards. And you were asking me how you do it. The dashboards is where you go to get it, and I'll walk you through a few of the reports that we use. A word on builds. Builds are a big, big part of our process. We use builds everywhere. So feature crews use builds to generally in a gated check-in form to validate every check-in that goes into the feature crew. They then use builds again to validate for their integration into the main branch to validate that they're done. The build lab does nightly builds every night to produce builds for the QA team. We use builds at all kinds of level, and the different builds have different levels of criteria for how much testing they do. And then we have these things which I've mentioned called quality gates. This is not an exhaustive list, but it's a pretty good representative list of what it means for a feature crew to be done. All your tasks have to be finished. Your tests have to be complete. All your bugs have to be fixed. You have to have a security plan that says you understand the threats and mitigations. Static code analysis, code coverage. For example, we require 70% code coverage by DLL. So every DLL has to have 70% code coverage from the tests before you can say that it's been tested. Is 70% a magic number? No, 70% is not a magic number. I don't have a magic number for you. That's the number we use. We generally find that around about 50% coverage is like falling off a log, write two or three tests, and you got 50% coverage. And then the higher you want to go, the harder it is. Getting to like 90% coverage is a tremendous amount of work because you're coding, you know, you're writing tests for every possible permutation that can happen. We've found 70% to be a good trade-off. Now, 70% as a min bar. So what it actually means is our average is more like 75%. Yeah.
Is that automated?
That's automated. That's all automated. Yes. Do we use PECs? We do. I wouldn't say uniformly. Some teams use it, some teams don't. PECs is a very cool tool that helps you explore all the code paths in an application by automatically generating test cases. It actually goes through, parses your binary, you know, picks apart your binary, understands all of the code paths through it, and figures out what data necessary to explore those code paths. It's a very nice tool. So that's a tool called PEX, P-E-X. No, that's not a feature enforcement. That's just a way of exploring code paths through your code without having to exhaustively write a gajillion unit tests for it.
You do automate this check?
We do. We do. Our code coverage is automated tests that we use our code coverage tools to measure code coverage, and you're not allowed to check in your feature crew is not allowed to integrate into main unless you have 70% minimum by DLL coverage. Oh, how do we do that? No, I think in the case of code coverage, it's not that particular one isn't. There's no check-in policy that enforces it. It's a requirement. We require literally when you can kind of see it here, but it's hard to read. Your deliverables are work item types. You have to sign off on having passed each of the quality gates. So you sign off that you did your code coverage and you got 70%. Deliverables are work item types as well, and they have sign offs for each of the quality gates in them. And somebody has to sign off on each one. So the question is: so did it work? Did it help? So this is a graph that I've shown a number of times that to kind of demonstrate the difference sort of pre-revolution in our process and post-revolution. No two development cycles are the same, so you can't just look at these really easily and say, oh, one had a lot more bugs than the other. Different releases, some releases are bigger, smaller. I'll point out the salient point. Let me tell you what you're looking at first. What you're looking at is a stack chart of bugs. And color coding is by team in the system. And you're looking at the stack chart is trending down towards the beta 1 release. The left one is for VS 2005. The right one is for VS 2008. Both are four-month periods. Okay. You can see both of them trend very nicely down to beta 1. The 2005 release had a lot more bugs. 23,000. Than the 2008 release. But as I say, it was a much more disruptive release. So the fact that it was a lot more bugs is not damning. The damning thing is if you look at that little purple line across the top, That's the total number of bugs, total identified bugs in the system. So the stack chart is the number of bugs that need to be fixed to ship beta 1. So there's some other bugs that don't need to be shipped fixed for beta 1. They'll get fixed for beta 2 or for RTM. That purple line is the bugs that need to get fixed for beta 2 or RTM. So as you can see, in that four-month period in which we fixed, you know, this chart would say we fixed 23,000 bugs. The reality is we fixed a lot more than that, because in that 4 months, the testers are busy entering bugs, right, as we're fixing them. So I actually would argue we fixed about 50,000 bugs in that period. In that four-month period in which we fixed 50,000 bugs, we actually made no progress whatsoever. The total number of bugs in the system stayed the same. If you look at the 2008 release, where we've adopted feature crews and we've pushed that earlier in the system, you'll see that that little blue line, which represents the same thing, is trending down at the same speed that the track to beta 1 is. So that, to me, is the victory. The victory is that we actually made a dent in the bugs as we fixed them. And that was an indication that we pulled the debt forward. So I'll end there. Thank you. And please, please, please fill out your survey form, the evaluation form. And I'll be up here to answer questions if you've got more questions.